Can't afford the outlay. Sorry. Now, if you was to talk to me again next year... Well, perhaps I will, the lightning rod salesman said, giving up. Perhaps I will. No one thought they could be struck by lightning until they were struck. It was a constant fact of this business. You couldn't make a fellow like this Carrick see that it was the cheapest form of fire insurance he could buy, but Dohay was a philosopher. After all, he had told the truth when he said he came in to lay the dust. To prove it, and to prove there were no hard feelings, he ordered another beer. But this time he did not match it with one for Carrick. The old campaigner slid onto the stool beside him. About 10 years ago, there was a fella got hit by lightning out on the golf course, he said. Killed him just as dead as shit. Now there's a man could have used a lightning rod right up on his head, am I right? He cackled, sending out a lot of stale beer breath into Dohay's face. Dohay smiled dutifully. All the coins in his pockets were fused together. That's what I heard. Lightning's a funny thing, sure is. Now, I remember one time. A funny thing, Dohay thought, letting the old man's words flow harmlessly over him, nodding in the right places out of instinct. A funny thing, all right, because it doesn't care who or what it hits, or when. He finished his beer and went out, carrying a satchel full of insurance against the wrath of God, maybe the only kind ever invented, with him. The heat struck him like a hammer blow, but still he paused for a moment in the mostly deserted parking lot, looking up at the unbroken line of roof ridge. 1995, 2995 tops, and the man couldn't afford the outlay. He'd saved $70 on his combined insurance the first year, but he couldn't afford the outlay. And you couldn't tell him different, with those clowns standing around yucking it up. Maybe someday he would be sorry. The seller of lightning rods got into his Buick, cranked up the air conditioning, and drove away west toward Concord and Berlin, his sample case on the seat beside him, running ahead of whatever storms might be whistling up the wind behind. 8. In early 1974, Walt Hazlitt passed his bar exams. He and Sarah threw a party for all of his friends, her friends, and their mutual friends, more than 40 people in all. The beer flowed like water, and after it was over, Walt said they could count themselves damn lucky not to have been evicted. When the last of the guests were seen out, at 3 in the morning, Walt had come back from the door to find Sarah in the bedroom, naked except for her shoes and the diamond chip earrings he had gone into the Hawk to give her for her birthday. They had made love not once, but twice, before falling into sodden slumber, from which they awoke at nearly noon with paralyzing hangovers. About 6 weeks later, Sarah discovered that she was pregnant. Neither of them ever doubted that conception had occurred on the night of the big party. In Washington, Richard Nixon was being pressed slowly into a corner, wrapped in a snarl of magnetic tapes. In Georgia, a peanut farmer, ex-Navy man, and current governor named James Earl Carter had begun talking with a number of close friends about running for the job Mr. Nixon would soon be vacating. In room 619 of the Eastern Maine Medical Center, Johnny Smith still slept. He had begun to pull into a fetal shape. Dr. Strawns, the doctor who had talked to Herb and Vera and Sarah in the conference room on the day following the accident, had died of burns in late 1973. His house had caught fire on the day after Christmas. The Bangor Fire Department had determined that the fire had been caused by a faulty set of Christmas tree ornaments. Two new doctors, Wyzak and Brown, interested themselves in Johnny's case. 4 days before Nixon resigned, Herb Smith fell into the foundation of a house he was building in Gray, landed on a wheelbarrow, and broke his leg. The bone was a long time healing, and it never really felt good again. He limped, and on wet days he began to use a cane. Vera prayed for him, and insisted that he wrap a cloth that had been personally blessed by the Reverend Freddie Coltsmore of Bessemer, Alabama, around the leg each night when he went to bed. The price of the blessed Coltsmore cloth, as Herb called it, was $35. It did no good that he was aware of. In the middle of October, shortly after Gerald Ford had pardoned the ex-president, Vera became sure that the world was going to end again. Herb realized what she was about barely in time. She'd made arrangements to give what little cash and savings they'd recouped since Johnny's accident to the Last Time Society of America. She tried to put the house up for sale and had made an arrangement with the Goodwill, which was going to send a van out in 2 days' time to pick up all the furniture. Herb found out when the realtor called him to ask if a prospective buyer could come and look at the house that afternoon. For the first time, he had genuinely lost his temper with Vera. "What in Christ's name did you think you were doing?" he roared, after dragging the last of the incredible story out of her. They were in the living room. He had just finished calling Goodwill to tell them to forget the van. Outside, rain fell in monotonous gray sheets.
"Don't blaspheme the name of the Savior, Herbert. Don't—"
"Shut up, shut up! I'm tired of listening to you rave about that crap!" She drew in a startled gasp. He limped over to her, his cane thumping the floor in counterpoint. She flinched back a little in her chair, and then looked up at him with that sweet martyr's expression that made him want, God forgive him, to bust her one across the head with his own damn walking stick. "You're not so far gone that you don't know what you're doing," he said. "You don't have that excuse. You snuck around behind my back, Vera. You—"
"I did not. That's a lie. I did no such—"
"You did," he bellowed. "Will you listen to me, Vera? This is where I'm drawing the line. You pray all you want. Praying's free. Write all the letters you want. A stamp still only costs 13 cents. If you want to take a bath in all the cheap, shitty lies those Jesus jumpers tell, if you want to go on with the delusions and the make-believe, you go on. But I'm not a part of it. Remember that. Do you understand me?"
"Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name."
"Do you understand me?"
"You think I'm crazy,"
she shouted at him, and her face crumpled and squeezed together in a terrible way. She burst into the braying, ugly tears of utter defeat and disillusion. "No," he said more quietly, "not yet. But maybe it's time for a little plain talk, Vera. And the truth is, I think you will be if you don't pull out of this and start facing reality."
"You'll see," she said through her tears. "You'll see. God knows the truth, but waits."
"Just as long as you understand that he's not going to have our furniture while he's waiting," Herb said grimly. "As long as we see eye to eye on that."
"It's last time," she told him. "The hour of the apocalypse is at hand."
"Yeah, that and 15 cents will buy you a cup of coffee, Vera." Outside, the rain fell in steady sheets. That was the year Herb turned 52, Vera 51, and Sarah Hazlitt 27. Johnny had been in his coma for 4 years. 9. The baby came on Halloween night. Sarah's labor lasted 9 hours. She was given mild whiffs of gas when she needed them, and at some point in her extremity, it occurred to her that she was in the same hospital as Johnny, and she called his name over and over again. Afterward, she barely remembered this, and certainly never told Walt. She thought she might have dreamed it. The baby was a boy. They named him Dennis Edward Hazlitt. He and his mother went home 3 days later, and Sarah was teaching again after the Thanksgiving holiday. Walt had landed what looked like a fine job with a Bangor firm of lawyers, and if all went well, they planned for Sarah to quit teaching in June of 1975. She wasn't all that sure she wanted to. She'd grown to like it. 10. On the first day of 1975, two small boys, Charlie Norton and Norm Lawson, both from Otisfield, Maine, were in the Norton's backyard having a snowball fight. Charlie was 8, Norm was 9. The day was overcast and drippy. Sensing that the end of the snowball fight was nearing, it was almost time for lunch, Norm charged Charlie, throwing a barrage of snowballs. Ducking and laughing, Charlie was at first forced back, and then turned tail and ran, jumping the low stone wall that divided the Norton backyard from the woods. He ran down the path that led toward Strimmer's Brook. As he went, Norm caught him a damn good one on the back of the hood. Then Charlie disappeared from sight. Norm jumped the wall and stood there for a moment, looking into the snowy woods and listening to the drip of meltwater from the birches, pines, and spruces.
"Come on back, chicken!"
Norm called, and made a series of high, gobbling sounds. Charlie didn't rise to the bait. There was no sign of him now, but the path descended steeply as it went down to the brook. Norm gobbled again and shifted irresolutely from one foot to the other. These were Charlie's woods, not his, Charlie's territory. Norm loved a good snowball fight when he was winning, but he didn't really want to go down there if Charlie was lying in ambush for him with half a dozen good, hard slush balls all ready to go. Nonetheless, he had taken half a dozen steps down the path when a high, breathless scream rose from below. Norm Lawson went as cold as the snow his green gum rubber boots were planted in. The two snowballs he had been holding dropped from his hands and plopped to the ground. The scream rose again, so thin it was barely audible.
"Jeepers creepers, he went and fell in the brook," Norm thought,
and that broke the paralysis of his fear. He ran down the path, slipping and sliding, falling right on his can once. His heartbeat roared in his ears. Part of his mind saw him fishing Charlie from the brook just before he went down for the third time and getting written up in boy's life as a hero. Three quarters of the way down the slope, the path dog-legged, and when he got around the corner, he saw that Charlie Norton hadn't fallen in Strimmer's brook after all. He was standing at the place where the path leveled out, and he was staring at something in the melting snow. His hood had fallen back, and his face was nearly as white as the snow itself. As Norm approached, he uttered that horrible, gasping out-of-breath scream again.
"What is it?" Norm asked, approaching. "Charlie, what's wrong?"
Charlie turned to him, his eyes huge, his mouth gaping. He tried to speak, but nothing came out of his mouth but two inarticulate grunts and a silver cord of saliva. He pointed instead. Norm came closer and looked. Suddenly, all the strength went out of his legs and he sat down hard. The world swam around him. Protruding from the melting snow were two legs clad in blue jeans. There was a loafer on one foot, but the other was bare, white, and defenseless. One arm stuck out of the snow, and the hand at the end of it seemed to plead for a rescue that had never come. The rest of the body was still mercifully hidden. Charlie and Norm had discovered the body of 17-year-old Carol Dunbarger, the fourth victim of the Castle Rock Strangler. It had been almost 2 years since he had last killed, and the people of Castle Rock, Strimmer's Brook formed the southern borderline between the towns of Castle Rock and Otisfield, had begun to relax, thinking the nightmare was finally over. It wasn't. Chapter 6 1 11 days after the discovery of the Dunbarger girl's body, a sleet and ice storm struck northern New England. On the 6th floor of the Eastern Maine Medical Center, everything was running just a little bit late in consequence. A lot of the staff had run into problems getting to work, and those that made it found themselves running hard just to stay even. It was after 9 a.m. when one of the aides, a young woman named Allison Conover, brought Mr. Starrett his light breakfast. Mr. Starrett was recovering from a heart attack and was doing his 16 in intensive care. A 16-day stay following a coronary was standard operation procedure. Mr. Starrett was doing nicely. He was in room 619, and he had told his wife privately that the biggest incentive to his recovery was the prospect of getting away from the living corpse in the room's second bed. The steady whisper of the poor guy's respirator made it hard to sleep, he told her. After a while, it got so you didn't know if you wanted it to go on whispering or stop. Stop dead, so to speak. The TV was on when Allison came in. Mr. Starrett was sitting up in bed with his control button in one hand. Today had ended, and Mr. Starrett had not yet decided to blank out My Backyard, the cartoon show that followed it. That would have left him alone with the sound of Johnny's respirator. "I'd about given up on you this morning," Mr. Starrett said, looking at his breakfast tray of orange juice, plain yogurt, and wheat flakes with no great joy. What he really craved were two cholesterol-filled eggs
fried over easy and sweating butter, with 5 slices of bacon on the side, not too crisp. The sort of fare that had, in fact, landed him here in the first place. At least according to his doctor, the bird brain. "The going's bad outside," Allison said shortly. 6 patients had already told her that they had about given up on her this morning, and the line was getting old. Allison was a pleasant girl, but this morning she was feeling harried. "Oh, sorry," Mr. Starrett said humbly. "Pretty slippery on the road, is it?" "It sure is," Allison said, thawing slightly. "If I didn't have my husband's 4-wheel drive today, I never would have made it." Mr. Starrett pushed the button that raised his bed so he could eat his breakfast comfortably. The electric motor that raised and lowered it was small but loud. The TV was also quite loud. Mr. Starrett was a little deaf, and as he had told his wife, the guy in the other bed had never complained about a little extra volume. Never asked to see what was on the other channels, either. He supposed a joke like that was in pretty poor taste, but when you'd had a heart attack and wound up in intensive care sharing a room with a human vegetable, you either learned a little black humor or you went crazy. Allison raised her voice a little to be heard over the whining motor and the TV as she finished setting up Mr. Starrett's tray. "There were cars off the road all up and down State Street Hill." "In the other bed," Johnny Smith said softly.
"The whole wad on 19. One way or the other. My girl's sick."
"You know, this yogurt isn't half bad," Mr. Starrett said. He hated yogurt, but he didn't want to be left alone until absolutely necessary. When he was alone, he kept taking his own pulse. "It tastes a little bit like wild hickory, and..."
"Did you hear something?" Allison asked. She looked around doubtfully. Mr. Starrett let go of the control button on the side of the bed, and the whine of the electric motor died. On the TV, Elmer Fudd took a pot shot at Bugs Bunny and missed.
"Nothing but the TV," Mr. Starrett said. "What'd I miss?"
"Nothing, I guess. It must have been the wind around the window." She could feel a stress headache coming on. Too much to do, and not enough people this morning to help her to do it. And she rubbed at her temples, as if to drive the pain away before it could get properly seated. On her way out, she paused and looked down at the man in the other bed for a moment. Did he look different somehow? As if he had shifted position? Surely not. Allison left the room and went on down the hall, pushing her breakfast cabinet ahead of her. It was as terrible a morning as she had feared it would be. Everything out of kilter, and by noon her head was pounding. She had quite understandably forgotten all about anything she might have heard that morning in room 619. But in the days that followed, she found herself looking more and more often at Smith. And by March, Allison had become almost sure that he had straightened a bit, come out of what the doctors called his pre-fetal position a little. Not much, just a little. She thought of mentioning it to someone, but in the end did not. After all, she was only an aide, little more than kitchen help. It really wasn't her place. 2. It was a dream, he guessed. He was in a dark, gloomy place. A hallway of some kind. The ceiling was too high to see. It was lost in the shadows. The walls were dark chrome steel. They opened out as they went upward. He was alone, but a voice floated up to where he stood, as if from a great distance. A voice he knew. Words that had been spoken to him in another place at another time. The voice frightened him. It was groaning and lost, echoing back and forth between the dark chrome steel like a trapped bird he remembered from his childhood. The bird had flown into his father's tool shed and hadn't the wit to get back out. He had panicked and gone swooping back and forth, cheeping in desperate alarm, battering itself against the walls until it had battered itself to death. This voice had the same doomed quality as that long-ago bird's cheeping. It was never going to escape this place. "You plan all your life, and you do what you can," the spectral voice groaned. "You never want nothing but the best, and the kid comes home with hair down to his asshole, and says the President of the United States is a pig. A pig. Shit. I don't...
Look out,
he wanted to say. He wanted to warn the voice, but he was mute. Look out for what? He didn't know. He didn't even know for sure who he was, although he had a suspicion that he had once been a teacher or preacher.
Jesus!
The faraway voice screamed. Lost voice, doomed, drowned. Silence then. Echoes dying away. Then, in a little while, it would start again. So after a while, he did not know how long, time seemed to have no meaning or relevance in this place. He began to grope his way down the hall, calling in return, or perhaps only calling in his mind, perhaps hoping that he and the owner of the voice could find their way out together, perhaps only hoping to give some comfort and receive some in return. But the voice kept getting further and further away, dimmer and fainter, far and wee, until it was just an echo of an echo, and then it was gone. He was alone now, walking down this gloomy and deserted hall of shadows, and it began to seem to him that it wasn't an illusion or a mirage or a dream, at least not of the ordinary kind. It was as if he had entered limbo, a weird conduit between the land of the living and that of the dead. But toward which end was he moving? Things began to come back, disturbing things. They were like ghosts that joined him on his walk, fell in on either side of him, in front of him, behind him, until they circled around him in an eldritch ring. Weave a circle around him thrice and touch his eyes with holy dread. Was that how it went? He could almost see them, all the whispering voices of purgatory. There was a wheel turning and turning in the night, a wheel of the future, red and black, life and death, slowing. Where had he laid his bet? He couldn't remember, and he should be able to, because the stakes were his existence. In or out, it had to be one or the other. His girl was sick. He had to get her home. After a while, the hallway began to seem brighter. At first he thought it was imagination, a sort of dream within a dream, if that were possible. But after an unknown length of time, the brightness became too marked to be an illusion. The whole experience of the corridor seemed to become less dreamlike. The walls drew back until he could barely see them, and the dull, dark color changed to a sad and misty gray, the color of twilight on a warm and overcast March afternoon. It began to seem that he was not in a hallway at all anymore, but in a room, almost in a room, separated from it by the thinnest of membranes, a sort of placental sac, like a baby waiting to be born. Now he heard other voices, not echoey, but dull and thudding, like the voices of nameless gods speaking in forgotten tongues. Little by little, these voices came clearer, until he could nearly make out what they were saying. He began to open his eyes from time to time, or thought he did, and he could actually see the owners of those voices, bright, glowing, spectral shapes with no faces at first, sometimes moving about the room, sometimes bending over him. It didn't occur to him to try speaking to them, at least not at first. It came to him that this might be some sort of afterlife, and these bright shapes, the shapes of angels. The faces, like the voices, began to come clearer with time. He saw his mother once, leaning into his field of vision and slowly thundering something totally without meaning into his upturned face. His father was there another time. Dave Pelson from school, a nurse he came to know. He believed her name was Mary or possibly Marie. Faces, voices coming closer, gelling together. Something else crept in. A feeling that he had changed. He didn't like the feeling. He distrusted it. It seemed to him that whatever the change was, it was nothing good. It seemed to him that it meant sorrow and bad times. He had gone into the darkness with everything, and now it felt to him that he was coming out of it with nothing at all, except for some secret strangeness. The dream was ending. Whatever it had been, the dream was ending. The room was very real now, very close. The voices, the faces. He was going to come into the room, and it suddenly seemed to him that what he wanted to do was turn and run, to go back down that dark hallway forever. The dark hallway was not good, but it was better than this new feeling of sadness and impending loss. He turned and looked behind him, and yes, it was there. The place where the room's walls changed to dark chrome, a corner beside one of the chairs where, unnoticed by the bright people who came and went, the room became a passageway into what he now suspected was eternity. The place where that other voice had gone, the voice of the cab driver. Yes, that memory was all there now. The cab ride, the driver bemoaning his son's long hair, bemoaning the fact that his son thought Nixon was a pig. Then the headlights breasting the hall, a pair on each side of the white line. The crash, no pain, but the knowledge that his thighs had connected with the taxi meter, hard enough to rip it out of its frame. There had been a sensation of cold wetness, and then the dark hallway, and now this. Choose, something inside whispered. Choose, or they'll choose for you. They'll rip you out of this place, whatever and wherever it is, like doctors ripping a baby out of its mother's womb by cesarean section. And then Sarah's face came to him. She had to be out there someplace, although hers had not been one of the bright faces bending over his. She had to be out there, worried and scared. She was almost his now. He felt that. He was going to ask her to marry him. That feeling of unease came back, stronger than ever. And this time it was all mixed up with Sarah. But wanting her was stronger, and he made his decision. He turned his back on the dark place, and when he looked back over his shoulder later on, it had disappeared. There was nothing beside the chair but the smooth white wall of the room where he lay. Not long after, he began to know where the room must be. It was a hospital room, of course. The dark hallway faded to a dreamy memory, never completely forgotten. But more important, more immediate, was the fact that he was John Smith. He had a girl named Sarah Bracknell, and he had been in a terrible accident. He suspected that he must be very lucky to be alive, and he could only hope that all his original equipment was still there and still functioning. He might be in Cleves Mills Community Hospital, but he guessed the EMMC was more likely. From the way he felt, he guessed he had been here for some time. He might have been blacked out for as long as a week or 10 days. It was time to get going again. Time to get going again. That was the thought in Johnny's mind when things finally gelled all the way back together, and he opened his eyes. It was May 17th, 1975. Mr. Starrett had long since gone home with standing orders to walk 2 miles a day and mend his high cholesterol ways. Across the room was an old man engaged in a weary 15th round with that all-time heavyweight champ, carcinoma. He slept the sleep of morphia, and the room was otherwise empty. It was 3:15 p.m. The TV screen was a drawn green shade.
There I am,
Johnny Smith croaked to no one at all. He was shocked by the weakness of his voice. There was no calendar in the room, and he had no way of knowing that he had been out of it for 4.5 years. 3. The nurse came in some 40 minutes later. She went over to the old man in the other bed, changed his IV feed, went into the bathroom, and came out with a blue plastic pitcher. She watered the old man's flowers. There were over 6 bouquets and a score of get-well cards standing open on his table and windowsill. Johnny watched her perform this homey chore, feeling as yet no urge to try his voice again. She put the pitcher back and came over to Johnny's bed. Going to turn my pillows, he thought. Their eyes met briefly, but nothing in hers changed. She doesn't know I'm awake. My eyes have been open before. It doesn't mean anything to her. She put her hand on the back of his neck. It was cool and comforting, and Johnny knew she had 3 children and that the youngest had lost most of the sight in one eye last 4th of July, a firecracker accident. The boy's name was Mark. She lifted his head, flipped his pillow over, and settled him back. She started to turn away, adjusting her nylon uniform at the hips, and then turned back, puzzled, belatedly thinking that there had been something new in his eyes, maybe, something that hadn't been there before. She glanced at him thoughtfully, started to turn away again, and he said, "Hello, Murray." She froze, and he could hear an ivory click as her teeth came suddenly and violently together. Her hand pressed against her chest just above the swell of her breasts. A small gold crucifix hung there. "Oh my God," she said. "You're awake. I thought you looked different. How did you know my name?" "I suppose I must have heard it." It was hard to talk, terribly hard. His tongue was a sluggish worm, seemingly unlubricated by saliva. She nodded. "You've been coming up for some time now. I'd better go down to the nurse's station and have Dr. Brown or Dr. Wyzak paged. They'll want to know you're back with us." But she stayed a moment longer, looking at him with a frank fascination that made him uneasy.
"Did I grow a third eye?" he asked.
She laughed nervously. "No, of course not. Excuse me." His eye caught on his own window ledge and his table pushed up against it. On the ledge was a faded African violet and a picture of Jesus Christ. It was the sort of picture of Jesus his mother favored, with Christ looking as if he was ready to bat cleanup for the New York Yankees, or something of a similar clean and athletic nature. But the picture was yellow. Yellow and beginning to curl at the corners. Sudden fear dropped over him like a suffocating blanket.
"Nurse!"
he called.
"Nurse!"
In the doorway, she turned back.
"Where are all my get-well cards?"
Suddenly, it was hard for him to breathe.
"The other guys got... Didn't anyone send me a card?"
She smiled, but it was forced. It was the smile of someone who's hiding something. Suddenly, Johnny wanted her by his bed. He would reach out and touch her. If he could touch her, he would know what she was hiding. "I'll have the doctor paged," she said, and left before he could say anything else. He looked at the African violet, at the aging picture of Jesus, baffled and afraid. After a little while, he drifted off to sleep again. 4. He was awake, Marie Michaud said. He was completely coherent. "Okay," Dr. Brown answered. "I'm not doubting you. If he woke up once, he'll wake up again, probably. It's just a matter of..." Johnny moaned. His eyes opened. They were blank, half rolled up. Then he seemed to see Marie, and his eyes came into focus. He smiled a little, but his face was still slack, as if only his eyes were awake, and the rest of him still slept. She had a sudden feeling that he was not looking at her, but into her.
"I think he'll be okay," Johnny said. "Once they clean that impacted cornea, the eye'll be as good as new. Should be."
Marie gasped harshly, and Brown glanced at her. "What is it?"
"He's talking about my boy," she whispered. "My Mark."
"No," Brown said. "He's talking in his sleep, that's all. Don't make a picture out of an inkblot, nurse."
"Yes, okay. But he's not asleep now, is he?"
"Marie?" Johnny asked. He smiled tentatively.
"I dozed off, didn't I?"
"Yes," Brown said. "You were talking in your sleep, gave Marie here a turn. Were you dreaming?"
"No, not that I remember. What did I say? And who are you?"
"I'm Dr. James Brown, just like the soul singer, only I'm a neurologist. You said..."
I think he'll be okay once they clean that impacted cornea. I think that was it, wasn't it, nurse? My boy's going to have that operation, Marie said. My boy Mark. I don't remember anything, Johnny said. I guess I was sleeping. He looked at Brown. His eyes were clear now and scared. I can't lift my arms. Am I paralyzed? Nope. Try your fingers. Johnny did. They all wiggled. He smiled. Super fine, Brown said. Tell me your name.
John Smith.
Good. And your middle name?
I don't have one.
That's fine. Who needs one? Nurse, go down to your station and find out who's in neurology tomorrow. I'd like to start a whole series of tests on Mr. Smith.
Yes, doctor.
And you might call Sam Wyzak. You'll get him at home or at the golf course.
Yes, doctor.
And no reporters, please. For your life. Brown was smiling but serious.
No, of course not.
She left, white shoes squeaking faintly.
Her little boy is going to be just fine, Johnny thought. I'll be sure to tell her. Dr. Brown, he said, where are my get-well cards? Didn't anybody send me a card?
Just a few more questions, Dr. Brown said smoothly. Do you recall your mother's name?
Of course I do.
Vera. Her maiden name?
Nason.
Your father's name?
Herbert. Herb. And why did you tell her no reporters?
Your mailing address.
RFD number 1, Pownall,
Johnny said promptly, and then stopped. An expression of comic surprise passed across his face.
I mean, well, I live in Cleves Mills now at 110 North Main Street. Why the hell did I give you my parents' address? I haven't lived there since I was 18.
And how old are you now?
I'll look it up on my driver's license, Johnny said. I want to know why I don't have any get-well cards. How long have I been in the hospital anyway? And which hospital is this?
It's the Eastern Maine Medical Center. And we'll get to all the rest of your questions if you'll just let me. Brown was sitting by the bed in a chair he had drawn over from the corner, the same corner where Johnny had once seen the passage leading away. He was making notes on a clipboard with a type of pen Johnny couldn't remember ever having seen before. It had a thick blue plastic barrel and a fibrous tip. It looked like the strange hybrid offspring of a fountain pen and a ballpoint. Just looking at it made that formless dread come back, and without thinking about it, Johnny suddenly seized Dr. Brown's left hand in one of his own. His arm moved creakily, as if there were invisible 60-pound weights tied to it, a couple below the elbow and a couple above. He captured the doctor's hand in a weak grip and pulled. The funny pen left a thick blue line across the paper. Brown looked at him, at first only curious, then his face drained of color. The sharp expression of interest left his eyes and was replaced with a muddy look of fear. He snatched his hand away. Johnny had no power to hold it, and for an instant, a look of revulsion crossed the doctor's face, as if he had been touched by a leper. Then it was gone, and he only looked surprised and disconcerted. What did you do that for?
Mr. Smith.
His voice faltered. Johnny's face had frozen in an expression of dawning comprehension. His eyes were the eyes of a man who has seen something terrible moving and shifting in the shadows, something too terrible to be described or even named. But it was a fact. It had to be named.
55 months? Johnny asked hoarsely. Going on 5 years? No. Oh, my God, no.
Mr. Smith, Brown said, now totally flustered. Please, it's not good for you to excite. Johnny raised his upper body perhaps 3 inches from the bed and then slumped back, his face shiny with sweat. His eyes rolled helplessly in their sockets.
I'm 27, he muttered. 27. Oh, my Jesus.
Brown swallowed and heard an audible click. When Smith had grabbed his hand, he'd felt a sudden onrush of bad feelings, childlike in their intensity. Crude images of revulsion had assaulted him. He'd found himself remembering a picnic in the country
when he had been 7 or 8, sitting down and putting his hand in something warm and slippery. He had looked around and seen that he had put his hand into the maggoty remains of a woodchuck that had lain under a laurel bush all that hot August. He had screamed then, and he felt a little bit like screaming now, except that the feeling was fading, dwindling, to be replaced with a question. How did he know? He touched me, and he knew. Then 20 years of education rose up strongly in him, and he pushed the notion aside. There were cases without number of comatose patients who had awakened with a dreamlike knowledge of many things that had gone on around them while they were in coma. Like anything else, coma was a matter of degree. Johnny Smith had never been a vegetable. His EEG had never gone flatline, and if it had, Brown would not be talking with him now. Sometimes being in a coma was a little like being behind a one-way glass. To the beholding eye, the patient was completely conked out, but the patient's senses might still continue to function in some low, power-down fashion, and that was the case here, of course. Marie Michaud came back in. Neurology is confirmed, and Dr. Wysak is on his way. I think Sam will have to wait until tomorrow to meet with Mr. Smith, Brown said. I want him to have 5 milligrams of Valium.
I don't want a sedative, Johnny said. I want to get out of here. I want to know what happened.
You'll know everything in time, Brown said. Right now it's important that you rest.
I've been resting for 4.5 years.
Then another 12 hours won't make much difference, Brown said inexorably. A few moments later, the nurse swabbed his upper arm with alcohol, and there was the sting of a needle. Johnny began to feel sleepy almost at once. Brown and the nurse began to look 12 feet tall.
Tell me one thing, at least, he said.
His voice seemed to come from far, far away. Suddenly, it seemed terribly important.
That pen. What do you call that pen?
This? Brown held it out from his amazing height. Blue plastic body, fibrous tip. It's called a flare. Now go to sleep, Mr. Smith. And Johnny did, but the word followed him down into his sleep like a mystic incantation, full of idiot meaning.
Flare, flare, flare.
5. Herb put the telephone down and looked at it. He looked at it for a long time. From the other room came the sound of the TV, turned up almost all the way. Oral Roberts was talking about football and the healing love of Jesus. There was a connection there someplace, but Herb had missed it. Because of the telephone call, Oral's voice boomed and roared. Pretty soon the show would end, and Oral would close it out by confidently telling his audience that something good was going to happen to them. Apparently, Oral was right.
My boy, Herb thought.
While Vera had prayed for a miracle, Herb had prayed for his boy to die. It was Vera's prayer that had been answered. What did that mean, and where did it leave him? And what was that going to do to her? He went into the living room. Vera was sitting on the couch. Her feet, encased in elastic pink mules, were up on a hassock. She was wearing her old gray robe. She was eating popcorn straight from the popper. Since Johnny's accident, she had put on nearly 40 pounds, and her blood pressure had skyrocketed. The doctor wanted to put her on medication, but Vera wouldn't have it. If it was the will of the Lord for her to have the high blood, she said, then she would have it. Herb had once pointed out that the will of the Lord had never stopped her from taking Bufferin when she had a headache. She had answered with her sweetest, long-suffering smile and her most potent weapon, silence. Who was on the phone? She asked him, not looking away from the TV. Oral had his arm around the well-known quarterback of an NFC team. He was talking to a hushed multitude. The quarterback was smiling modestly.
And you have all heard this fine athlete tell you tonight how he abused his body, his temple of God. And you have heard...
Herb snapped it off.
Herbert Smith!
She nearly spilled her popcorn sitting up.
I was watching, that was...
Johnny woke up.
Oral Roberts and...
The word snapped off in her mouth. She seemed to crouch back in her chair, as if he had taken a swing at her. He looked back, unable to say more, wanting to feel joy, but afraid, so afraid.
Johnny's?
She stopped, swallowed, then tried again.
Johnny? Our Johnny?
Yes. He spoke with Dr. Brown for nearly 15 minutes. Apparently, it wasn't that thing they thought, false waking, after all. He's coherent. He can move.
Johnny's awake?
Her hands came up to her mouth. The popcorn popper half full did a slow dipsy doodle off her lap and thumped to the rug, spilling popcorn everywhere. Her hands covered the lower half of her face. Above them, her eyes got wider and wider still, until, for a dreadful second, Herb was afraid they might fall out and dangle by their stalks. Then they closed. A tiny mewing sound came from behind her hands. Vera, are you all right?
Oh, my God, I thank you, for your will be done, my Johnny. You brought me, I knew you would, my Johnny. Oh, dear God, I will bring you my thanksgiving every day of my life for my Johnny, Johnny, Johnny.
Her voice was rising to a hysterical, triumphant scream. He stepped forward, grabbed the lapels of her robe, and shook her. Suddenly, time seemed to have reversed, doubled back on itself like strange cloth. They might have been back on the night when the news of the accident came to them, delivered through that same telephone in that same nook. By nook or by crook, Herb Smith thought crazily.
Oh, my precious God, my Jesus, oh, my Johnny, the miracle, like I said, the miracle.
Stop it, Vera. Her eyes were dark and hazy and hysterical.
Are you sorry he's awake again? After all these years of making fun of me? Of telling people I was crazy?
Vera, I never told anyone you were crazy.
You told them with your eyes, she shouted at him. But my God wasn't mocked, was he, Herbert? Was he?
No, he said. I guess not.
I told you God had a plan for my Johnny. Now you see his hand beginning to work.
She got up.
I've got to go to him. I've got to tell him.
She walked toward the closet where her coat hung, seemingly unaware that she was in her robe and nightgown. Her face was stunned with rapture. In some bizarre and almost blasphemous way, she reminded him of the way she had looked on the day they were married. Her pink mules crunched popcorn into the rug. Vera,
I've got to tell him that God's plan, Vera.
She turned to him, but her eyes were far away, with her Johnny. He went to her and put his hands on her shoulders.
You tell him that you love him, that you prayed, waited, watched. Who has a better right? You're his mother. You bled for him. Haven't I watched you bleed for him over the last 5 years? I'm not sorry he's back with us. You were wrong to say that. I don't think I can make of it what you do, but I'm not sorry. I bled for him too.
Did you? Her eyes were flinty, proud, and unbelieving.
Yes.
And I'm going to tell you something else, Vera. You're going to keep your trap shut about God and miracles and great plans until Johnny's up on his feet and able to...
I'll say what I have to say.
And able to think what he's doing. What I'm saying is that you're going to give him a chance to make something of it for himself before you start in on him.
You have no right to talk to me that way. No right at all.
I'm exercising my right as Johnny's dad, he said grimly. Maybe for the last time in my life. And you better not get in my way, Vera. You understand? Not you, not God, not the bleeding holy Jesus. You follow? She glared at him sullenly and said nothing. He's going to have enough to do just coping with the idea that he's been out like a light for 4.5 years. We don't know if he'll be able to walk again, in spite of the therapist that came in. We do know there'll have to be an operation on his ligaments if he even wants to try. Wyzak told us that. Probably more than one, and more therapy, and a lot of it's going to hurt him like hell. So tomorrow, you're just going to be his mother.
Don't you dare talk to me that way. Don't you dare!
If you start in sermonizing Vera, I'll drag you out of his room by the hair of your head. She stared at him, white-faced and trembling. Joy and fury were at war in her eyes. You better get dressed, Herb said. We ought to get going. It was a long, silent ride up to Bangor. The happiness they should have felt between them was not there. Only Vera's hot and militant joy. She sat bolt upright in the passenger seat, her Bible in her lap, open to the 23rd Psalm. 6. At 8:45 the next morning, Marie came into Johnny's room and said, Your mom and dad are here, if you're up to seeing them. Yes, I'd like that. He felt much better this morning, stronger and less disoriented, but the thought of seeing them scared him a little. In terms of his conscious recollection, he had seen them about 5 months ago. His father had been working on the foundation of a house that had now probably been standing for 3 years or more. His mom had fixed him home-baked beans and apple pie for dessert and had clucked over how thin he was getting. He caught Marie's hand weakly as she turned to go. Do they look all right? I mean, they look fine. Oh, good. You can only have half an hour with them now. Some more time this evening if the neurology series doesn't prove too tiring. Dr. Brown's orders? And Dr. Wysak's? All right, for a while. I'm not sure how long I want to be poked and prodded. Marie hesitated. Something? Johnny asked. No, not now. You must be anxious to see your folks. I'll send them in. He waited, nervous. The other bed was empty. The cancer patient had been moved out while Johnny slept off his Valium pop. The door opened. His mother and father came in. Johnny felt simultaneous shock and relief. Shock because they had aged. It was all true. Relief because the changes in them did not yet seem mortal. And if that could be said of them, perhaps it could be said of him as well. But something in him had changed. Changed drastically. And it might be mortal. That was all he had time to think before his mother's arms were around him, her violet sachet strong in his nostrils, and she was whispering, Thank God, Johnny. Thank God you're awake. He hugged her back as best he could. His arms still had no power to grip and fell away quickly. And suddenly, in 6 seconds, he knew how it was with her, what she thought, and what was going to happen to her. Then it was gone, fading like that dream of the dark corridor. But when she broke the embrace to look at him, the look of zealous joy in her eyes had been replaced with one of thoughtful consideration. The words seemed to come out of him of their own. Let them give you the medicine, Mom. That's best. Her eyes widened. She wet her lips. And then Herb was beside her, his eyes filled with tears. He had lost some weight, not as much as Vera had put on, but he was noticeably thinner. His hair was going fast, but the face was the same, homely and plain and well-loved. He took a large brakeman's bandana from his back pocket and wiped his eyes with it. Then he stuck out his hand. Hi, son, he said. Good to have you back. Johnny shook his father's hand as well as he could. His pale and strengthless fingers were swallowed up in his father's red hand. Johnny looked from one to the other, his mother in a bulky powder blue pantsuit, his father in a really hideous houndstooth jacket that looked as if it should belong to a vacuum cleaner salesman in Kansas, and he burst into tears. I'm sorry, he said. I'm sorry, it's just that— You go on, Vera said, sitting on the bed beside him. Her face was calm and clear now. There was more mother than madness in it. You go on and cry. Sometimes that's best. And Johnny did. 7. Herb told him his Aunt Germaine had died. Vera told him that the money for the Palinol Community Hall had finally been raised and the building had commenced a month ago, as soon as the frost was out of the ground. Herb added that he had put in a bid, but he guessed honest work cost too dear for them to want to pay. Oh, shush, you sore loser, Vera said. There was a little silence, and then Vera spoke again. I hope you realize that your recovery is a miracle of God, Johnny. The doctors despaired. In Matthew chapter 9, we read,
Vera, Herb said warningly.
Of course it was a miracle, Mom. I know that. You do? Yes. And I want to talk about it with you. Hear your ideas about what it means, just as soon as I get on my feet again.
She was staring at him, open-mouthed. Johnny glanced past her at his father, and their eyes met for a moment. Johnny saw great relief in his father's eyes. Herb nodded imperceptibly.
A conversion,
Vera ejaculated loudly.
My boy has had a conversion, oh praise God.
Vera, hush, Herb said. Best to praise God in a lower voice when you're in the hospital.
I don't see how anybody could not call it a miracle, Mom. And we're going to talk about it a lot, just as soon as I'm out of here.
You're going to come home, she said, back to the house where you were raised. I'll nurse you back to health, and we'll pray for understanding.
He was smiling at her, but holding the smile was an effort.
You bet.
Mom, would you go down to the nurse's station and ask Maria if I can have some juice? Or maybe some ginger ale? I guess I'm not used to talking in my throat.
Of course I will.
She kissed his cheek and stood up.
Oh, you're so thin. But I'll fix that when you get home.
She left the room, casting a single victorious glance at Herb as she went. They heard her shoes tapping off down the hall.
How long has she been that way? Johnny asked quietly.
Herb shook his head.
It's come a little at a time since your accident, but it had its start long before that. You know. You remember.
Is she?
I don't know. There are people down south that handle snakes. I call them crazy. She doesn't do that. How are you, Johnny? Really?
I don't know, Johnny said. Daddy, where's Sarah?
Herb leaned forward and clasped his hands between his knees.
I don't like to tell you this, John, but
she's married. She got married.
Herb didn't answer. Without looking directly at Johnny, he nodded his head.
Oh, God, Johnny said hollowly. I was afraid of that.
She's been Mrs. Walter Hazlitt for going on 3 years. He's a lawyer. They have a baby boy. John, no one really believed you were going to wake up. Except for your mother, of course. None of us had any reason to believe you would wake up. His voice was trembling now, hoarse with guilt.
The doctor said, oh, never mind what they said. Even I gave you up. I hate like hell to admit it, but it's true. All I can ask you is to try to understand about me. And Sarah.
He tried to say that he did understand, but all that would come out was a sickly sort of croak. His body felt sick and old, and suddenly he was drowning in his sense of loss. The lost time was suddenly sitting on him like a load of bricks. A real thing, not just a vague concept.
Johnny, don't take on. There are other things, good things.
It's going to take some getting used to, he managed.
Yeah, I know.
Do you ever see her?
We write back and forth once in a while. We got acquainted after your accident. She's a nice girl, real nice. She's still teaching at Cleves, but I understand she's getting done this June. She's happy, John.
Good.
He said thickly. I'm glad someone is.
Son, I hope you're not telling secrets,
Vera Smith said brightly, coming back into the room. She had an ice-clogged pitcher in one hand.
They said you weren't ready for fruit juice, Johnny, so I brought you ginger ale.
That's fine, Mom.
She looked from Herb to Johnny and back to Herb again.
Have you been telling secrets? Why the long faces?
I was just telling Johnny he's going to have to work hard if he wants to get out of here, said Herb. Lots of therapy.
Now, why would you want to talk about that now?
She poured ginger ale into Johnny's glass.
Everything's going to be fine now, you'll see.
She popped a flexible straw into the glass and handed it to him.
Now you drink all of it, she said, smiling. It's good for you.
Johnny did drink all of it. It tasted bitter. Chapter 7 1 Close your eyes, Dr. Wysak said. He was a small, roly-poly man with an incredibly styled head of hair and spade sideburns. Johnny couldn't get over all that hair. A man with a haircut like that in 1970 would have had to fight his way out of every bar in eastern Maine, and a man Wysak's age would have been considered ripe for committal. All that hair, man. He closed his eyes. His head was covered with electrical contact points. The contacts went to wires that fed into a wall console EEG. Dr. Brown and a nurse stood by the console, which was calmly extruding a wide sheet of graph paper. Johnny wished the nurse could have been Marie Michaud. He was a little scared. Dr. Wysak touched his eyelids, and Johnny jerked. No, hold still, Johnny. These are the last two. Just there.
All right, doctor,
the nurse said. A low hum. All right, Johnny. Are you comfortable?
Feels like there are pennies on my eyelids.
Yes. You'll get used to that in no time. Now, let me explain to you this procedure. I'm going to ask you to visualize a number of things. You will have about 10 seconds on each, and there are 20 things to visualize in all. You understand?
Yes.
Very fine. We begin. Dr. Brown? All ready. Excellent. Johnny, I ask you to see a table. On this table, there is an orange. Johnny thought about it. He saw a small card table with folding steel legs. Resting on it, a little off-center, was a large orange with the word Sunkissed stamped on its pocky skin. Good, Wysak said.
Can that gadget see my orange?
No. Well, yes. In a symbolic way, it can. The machine is tracing your brainwaves. We are searching for blocks, Johnny, areas of impairment, possible indications of continuing intracranial pressure. Now I ask you to shush with the questions.
All right.
Now I ask you to see a television. It is on, but not receiving a station. Johnny saw the TV that was in the apartment, had been in his apartment. The screen was bright gray with snow. The tips of the rabbit ears were wrapped with tinfoil for better reception. Good. The series went on. For the 11th item, Wysak said, Now I ask you to see a picnic table on the left side of a green lawn. Johnny thought about it, and in his mind he saw a lawn chair. He frowned. Something wrong? Wysak asked.
No, not at all, Johnny said. He thought harder. Picnics, wieners, a charcoal brazier.
Associate, damn it, associate.
How hard can it be to see a picnic table in your mind? You've only seen 1,000 of them in your life.
Associate your way to it. Plastic spoons and forks, paper plates, his father in a chef's hat holding a long fork in one hand and wearing an apron with a motto printed across it in tipsy letters. The cook needs a drink. His father making burgers. And then they would all go sit at the...
Ah! Here it came.
Johnny smiled. And then the smile faded. This time the image in his mind was of a hammock.
Shit.
No picnic table?
It's the weirdest thing. I can't quite seem to think of it. I mean, I know what it is, but I can't see it in my mind.
Is that weird or is that weird? Never mind. Try this one. A globe of the world sitting on the hood of a pickup truck. That one was easy. On the 19th item, a rowboat lying at the foot of a street sign.
Who thinks these things up? Johnny wondered.
It happened again. It was frustrating. He saw a beach ball lying beside a gravestone. He concentrated harder and saw a turnpike overpass. Wysak soothed him, and a few moments later, the wires were removed from his head and eyelids.
Why couldn't I see those things? He asked, his eyes moving from Wysak to Brown. What's the problem?
Hard to say with any real certainty, Brown said. It may be a kind of spot amnesia, or it may be that the accident destroyed a small portion of your brain, and I mean a really microscopic bit. We don't really know what the problem is, but it's pretty obvious that you've lost a number of trace memories. We happened to strike two. You'll probably come across more. Wyzak said abruptly, You sustained the head injury when you were a child, yes? Johnny looked at him doubtfully. There is an old scar, Wyzak said. There is a theory, Johnny, backed by a good deal of statistical research. Research that is nowhere near complete, Brown said almost primly. That is true. But this theory supposes that the people who tend to recover from long-term coma are people who have sustained some sort of brain injury at a previous time. It is as though the brain has made some adaptation as the result of the first injury that allows it to survive the second. It's not proven, Brown said. He seemed to disapprove of Wyzak even bringing it up. The scar is there, Wyzak said. Can you not remember what happened to you, Johnny? I would guess you must have blacked out. Did you fall down the stairs? A bicycle accident, perhaps? The scar says this happened to a young boy. Johnny thought hard, then shook his head. Have you asked my mom and dad? Neither of them can remember any sort of head injury. Nothing occurs to you? For a moment, something did. A memory of smoke, black and greasy, and smelling like rubber. Cold. Then it was gone. Johnny shook his head. Wyzak sighed, then shrugged. You must be tired. Yes, a little bit. Brown sat on the edge of the examination table. It's 11:15. You've worked hard this morning. Dr. Wyzak and I will answer a few questions if you like. Then you go up to your room for a nap. Okay? Okay, Johnny said. The pictures you took of my brain. The CAT scan, Wyzak nodded. Computerized axial tomography. He took a box of chiclets and shook three of them into his mouth. The CAT scan is really a series of brain x-rays, Johnny. The computer highlights the pictures and...
What did it tell you? How long have I got?
What is this how long have I got stuff, Brown asked. It sounds like a line from an old movie. I've heard that people who come out of long-term comas don't always last so long, Johnny said. They lapse back. It's like a light bulb going really bright before it burns out for good. Wyzak laughed hard. It was a hearty, bellowing laugh, and it was something of a wonder that he didn't choke on his gum.
Oh, such melodrama! He put a hand on Johnny's chest. You think Jim and I are babies in this field? No. We are neurologists. What you Americans call high-priced talent, which means we are only stupid about the functions of the human brain instead of out-and-out ignoramuses. So I tell you, yes, there have been lapsebacks, but you will not lapse. I think we can say that, Jim. Yes? Okay.
Yes, Brown said. We haven't been able to find very much in the way of significant impairment. Johnny, there's a guy in Texas who was in a coma for 9 years. Now he's a bank loan officer, and he's been doing that job for 6 years. Before that, he was a teller for 2 years. There's a woman in Arizona who was down for 12 years. Something went wrong with the anesthesia while she was in labor. Now she's in a wheelchair, but she's alive and aware. She came out of it in 1969 and met the baby she had delivered 12 years before. The baby was in the 7th grade and an honor student.
Am I going to be in a wheelchair? Johnny asked. I can't straighten my legs out. My arms are a little better, but my legs...
He trailed off, shaking his head. The ligaments shorten, Wyzak said. Yes, that's why comatose patients begin to pull into what we call the pre-fetal position. But we know more about the physical degeneration that occurs in coma than we used to. We are better at holding it off. You have been exercised regularly by the hospital physical therapist, even in your sleep, and different patients react to coma in different ways. Your deterioration has been quite slow, Johnny. As you say, your arms are remarkably responsive and able, but there has been deterioration. Your therapy will be long and... Should I lie to you? No, I don't think so. It will be long and painful. You will shed your tears. You may come to hate your therapist. You may come to fall in love with your bed. And there will be operations. Only one, if you are very, very lucky, but perhaps as many as four, to lengthen those ligaments. These operations are still new. They may succeed completely, partially, or not at all. And yet, as God wills it, I believe you will walk again. I don't believe you will ever ski or leap hurdles, but you may run, and you will certainly swim.
Thank you, Johnny said. He felt a sudden wave of affection for this man with the accent and the strange haircut. He wanted to do something for Wyzak in return, and with that feeling came the urge, almost the need, to touch him. He reached out suddenly and took Wyzak's hand in both of his own. The doctor's hand was big, deeply lined, warm.
Yes, Wyzak said kindly, and what is this?
And suddenly things changed. It was impossible to say how, except that suddenly Wyzak seemed very clear to him. Wyzak seemed to stand forth, outlined in a lovely clear light. Every mark and mole and line on Wyzak's face stood in relief, and every line told its own story. He began to understand.
I want your wallet, Johnny said.
Wyzak and Brown exchanged a startled glance.
There's a picture of your mother in your wallet, and I need to have it, Johnny said. Please.
How did you know that?
Please.
Wyzak looked into Johnny's face for a moment, and then slowly dug under his smock and produced an old Lord Buxton, bulgy and out of shape.
How did you know I carry a picture of my mother? She's dead. She died when the Nazis occupied Warsaw.
Johnny snatched the wallet from Wyzak's hand. Both he and Brown looked stunned. Johnny opened it, dismissed the plastic picture pockets, and dug in the back instead, his fingers hurrying past old business cards, receipted bills, a canceled check, an old ticket to some political function. He came up with a small snapshot that had been laminated in plastic. The picture showed a young woman, her features plain, her hair drawn back under a kerchief. Her smile was radiant and youthful. She held the hand of a young boy. Beside her was a man in the uniform of the Polish army. Johnny pressed the picture between his hands and closed his eyes, and for a moment there was darkness, and then rushing out of the darkness came a wagon. No, not a wagon, a hearse. A horse-drawn hearse. The lamps had been muffled in black sacking. Of course it was a hearse, because they were dying by the hundreds, yes, by the thousands, no match for the panzers, the Wehrmacht, 19th-century cavalry against the tanks and machine guns, explosions, screaming, dying men, a horse with its guts blown out and its eyes rolling wildly, showing the white, an overturned cannon behind it, and still they come. Wyzak comes, standing in his stirrups, his sword held high in the slanting rain of late summer 1939, his men following him, stumbling through the mud. The turret gun of the Nazi Tiger tank tracks him, braces him, brackets him, fires, and suddenly he's gone below the waist, the sword flying out of his hand, and down the road is Warsaw. The Nazi wolf is loose in Europe.
Really, we have to put a stop to this, Brown said, his voice far away and worried. You're overexciting yourself, Johnny.
The voices came from far away, from a hallway in time. He's put himself in some kind of trance, Wyzak said.
Hot in here. He was sweating. He was sweating because the city's on fire. Thousands are fleeing. A truck is roaring from side to side down a cobbled street, and the back of the truck is full of waving German soldiers in coal scuttle helmets, and the young woman is not smiling now. She is fleeing. No reason not to flee. The child has been sent to safety, and now the truck jumps the curb. The mud guard strikes her, shattering her hip and sending her flying through a plate glass window and into a clock shop, and everything begins to chime. Chime because of the time. The chime time is
6 o'clock. Johnny said thickly. His eyes had rolled up to straining, bulging whites. September 2nd, 1939, and all the cuckoo birds are singing. Oh my God, what is it we have? Wyzak whispered. The nurse had backed up against the EEG console, her face pale and scared. Everyone is scared now because death is in the air. It's always in the air in this place. This hospital, smell of ether. They're screaming in the place of death. Poland is dead. Poland has fallen before the lightning warfare of Wehrmacht Blitzkrieg. Shattered hip. The man in the next bed calling for water. Calling, calling, calling. She remembers. The boy is safe. What boy? She doesn't know. What boy? What is her name? She doesn't remember. Only that... The boy is safe, Johnny said thickly. Uh-huh.
We have to put a stop to this, Brown repeated. How do you suggest we do that? Wyzak asked, his voice brittle. It has gone too far to...
Voices fading. The voices are under clouds. Everything is under the clouds. Europe is under the clouds of war. Everything is under the clouds, but the peaks, the mountain peaks of Switzerland. Switzerland, and now her name is Berents. Her name is Johanna Berents, and her husband is an engineer or an architect, whichever it is that builds the bridges. He builds in Switzerland, and there is goat's milk, goat's cheese, a baby. Oh, the labor. The labor is terrible. She needs drugs, morphine. This Johanna Berents, because of the hip, the broken hip, it is mended, it has gone to sleep, but now it awakes and begins to scream as her pelvis spreads to let the baby out. One baby, two, and three, and four, they don't all come at once, no, they are a harvest of years, they are...
The babies,
Johnny lilted, and now he spoke in a woman's voice, not his own voice at all. It was the voice of a woman. Then gibberish and song came from his mouth. What in the name of God, Brown began. Polish, it is Polish, Wyzak cried. His eyes were bulging, his face pale. It is a cradle song and it isn't Polish. My God, my Christ, what is it we have here? Wyzak leaned forward as if to cross the years with Johnny, as if to leap them, as if to... Bridge, a bridge, it is in Turkey. Then a bridge somewhere hot in the far east. Is it Laos? Can't tell. Lost a man there. We lost Hans there. Then a bridge in Virginia. A bridge over the Rappahannock River. And another bridge in California. We are applying for citizenship now. And we go to classes in a hot little room in the back of a post office where it always smells of glue. It is 1963, November. And when we hear Kennedy has been killed in Dallas, we weep. And when the little boy salutes his father's coffin, she thinks, the boy is safe. And it brings back memories of some burning, some great burning and sorrow. What boy? She dreams about the boy. It makes her head hurt. And the man dies. Helmut Berents dies. And she and the children live in Carmel, California, in a house on, can't see the street sign. It's in the dead zone, like the rowboat. Like the picnic table on the lawn. It's in the dead zone, like Warsaw. The children go away. She goes to their graduation ceremonies one by one, and her hip hurts. One dies in Vietnam. The rest of them are fine. One of them is building bridges. Her name is Johanna Berents. And late at night, alone now, she sometimes thinks in the ticking darkness, the boy is safe. Johnny looked up at them. His head felt strange. That peculiar light around Wyzak had gone. He felt like himself again, but weak and a little pukey. He looked at the picture in his hands for a moment, and then handed it back.
Johnny, Brown said, are you all right?
Tired, he muttered.
Can you tell us what happened to you?
He looked at Wyzak.
Your mother is alive, he said.
No, Johnny. She died many years ago, in the war. A German troop truck knocked her through a plate glass show window and into a clock shop, Johnny said. She woke up in a hospital with amnesia. She had no identification, no papers. She took the name Johanna, somebody. I didn't get that, but when
The war was over, she went to Switzerland and married a Swiss engineer, I think. His specialty was building bridges, and his name was Helmut Behrens. So her married name is Johanna Behrens. The nurse's eyes were getting bigger and bigger. Dr. Brown's face was tight, either because he had decided Johnny was having them all on, or perhaps just because he didn't like to see his neat schedule of tests disrupted. But Wyzak's face was still and thoughtful. She and Helmut Behrens had 4 children, Johnny said in that same calm, washed-out voice. His job took him all over the world. He was in Turkey for a while, somewhere in the Far East, Laos, I think, maybe Cambodia. Then he came here, Virginia first, then some other places I didn't get, finally California. He and Johanna became U.S. citizens. Helmut Behrens is dead. One of the children they had is also dead. The others are alive and fine, but she dreams about you sometimes. And in the dream she thinks, the boy is safe. But she doesn't remember your name. Maybe she thinks it's too late. California? Wyzak said thoughtfully. Sam, Dr. Brown said. Really, you mustn't encourage this. Where in California, John? Carmel, by the sea. But I couldn't tell which street. It was there, but I couldn't tell. It was in a dead zone, like the picnic table and the rowboat. But she's in Carmel, California. Johanna Behrens. She's not old. No, of course she would not be old, Sam Wyzak said in that same thoughtful, distant tone. She was only 24 when the Germans invaded Poland. Dr. Wyzak, I have to insist, Brown said harshly. Wyzak seemed to come out of a deep study. He looked around as if noticing his younger colleague for the first time. Of course, he said. Of course you must. And John has had his question and answer period. Although I believe he has told us more than we have told him. That's nonsense, Brown said curtly, and Johnny thought, he's scared. Scared spitless. Wyzak smiled at Brown, and then at the nurse. She was eyeing Johnny as if he were a tiger in a poorly built cage. Don't talk about this, nurse. Not to your supervisor, your mother, your brother, your lover, or your priest. Understood? Yes, doctor, the nurse said. But she'll talk, Johnny thought, and then glanced at Wyzak. And he knows it. 2. He slept most of the afternoon. Around 4 p.m., he was rolled down the corridor to the elevator, taken down to neurology, and there were more tests. Johnny cried. He seemed to have very little control over the functions adults are supposed to be able to control. On his way back up, he urinated on himself and had to be changed like a baby. The first, but far from the last, wave of deep depression washed over him, carried him limply away, and he wished himself dead. Self-pity accompanied the depression, and he thought how unfair this was. He had done a Rip Van Winkle. He couldn't walk. His girl had married another man, and his mother was in the grip of a religious mania. He couldn't see anything ahead that looked worth living for. Back in his room, the nurse asked him if he would like anything. If Marie had been on duty, Johnny would have asked for ice water, but she had gone off at 3. No, he said, and rolled over to face the wall. After a little while, he slept. Chapter 8 1 His father and mother came in for an hour that evening, and Vera left a bundle of tracts. We're going to stay until the end of the week, Herb said. And then, if you're still doing fine, we'll be going back to Pownell for a while. But we'll be back up every weekend. I want to stay with my boy, Vera said loudly. It's best that you don't, Mom, Johnny said. The depression had lifted a little bit, but he remembered how black it had been. If his mother started to talk about God's wonderful plan for him while he was in that state, he doubted if he would be able to hold back his cackles of hysterical laughter. You need me, John. You need me to explain. First, I need to get well, Johnny said. You can explain after I can walk, okay? She didn't answer. There was an almost comically stubborn expression on her face, except there was nothing very funny about it, nothing at all. Nothing but a quirk of fate, that's all. 5 minutes earlier or later on that road could have changed everything. Now look at us, all of us fucked over royally, and she believes it's God's plan. It's either that or go completely crazy, I suppose.
To break the awkward silence, Johnny said, "Well, did Nixon get reelected, Dad? Who ran against him?"
"He got reelected," Herb said. "He ran against McGovern."
"Who?"
"McGovern, George McGovern, senator from South Dakota."
"Not Muskie?"
"No, but Nixon's not president anymore. He resigned."
"What?"
"He was a liar," Vera said dourly. "He became swollen with pride, and the Lord brought him low."
"Nixon resigned?" Johnny was flabbergasted.
"Him?"
"It was either quit or be fired," Herb said. "They were getting ready to impeach him."
Johnny suddenly realized there had been some great and fundamental upheaval in American politics, almost surely as a result of the war in Vietnam, and he had missed it. For the first time, he really felt like Rip Van Winkle. How much had things changed? He was almost afraid to ask. Then a really chilling thought occurred.
Agnew? Agnew's president?
"Ford," Vera said. "A good, honest man."
"Henry Ford is president of the United States?"
"Not Henry," she said. "Jerry."
He stared from one to the other, more than half convinced that all this was a dream or a bizarre joke.
"Agnew resigned too," Vera said. Her lips were pressed thin and white. "He was a thief. He accepted a bribe right in his office. That's what they say."
"He didn't resign over the bribe," Herb said. "He resigned over some mess back in Maryland. He was up to his neck in it, I guess. Nixon nominated Jerry Ford to become vice president. Then Nixon resigned last August and Ford took over. He nominated Nelson Rockefeller to be vice president, and that's where we are now."
"A divorced man," Vera said grimly. "God forbid he ever becomes the president."
"What did Nixon do?" Johnny asked. "Jesus Christ,
He glanced at his mother, whose brow had clouded instantly.
"I mean, holy crow, if they were going to impeach him."
"You needn't take the Savior's name in vain over a bunch of crooked politicians," Vera said. "It was Watergate."
"Watergate? Was that an operation in Vietnam, something like that?"
"The Watergate Hotel in Washington," Herb said. "Some Cubans broke into the offices of the Democratic Committee there and got caught. Nixon knew about it. He tried to cover it up."
"Are you kidding?" Johnny managed at last.
"It was the tapes," Vera said, "and that John Dean. Nothing but a rat deserting a sinking ship, that's what I think. A common tattletale."
"Daddy, can you explain this to me?"
"I'll try," Herb said, "but I don't think the whole story has come out, even yet. And I'll bring you the books. There's been about 1 million books written on it already, and I guess there'll be 1 million more before it's finally done."
Just before the election, in the summer of 1972... It was 10:30 and his parents were gone. The lights on the ward had been dimmed. Johnny couldn't sleep. It was all dancing around in his head, a frightening jumble of new input. The world had changed more resoundingly than he would have believed possible in so short a time. He felt out of step and out of tune. Gas prices had gone up nearly 100%, his father told him. At the time of his accident, you could buy regular gas for 30 or 32 cents a gallon. Now it was 54 cents, and sometimes there were lines at the pumps. The legal speed limit all over the country was 55 miles an hour, and the long-haul truckers had almost revolted over that. But all of that was nothing. Vietnam was over. It had ended. The country had finally gone communist. Herb said it had happened just as Johnny began to show signs that he might come out of his coma. After all those years and all that bloodshed, the heirs of Uncle Ho had rolled up the country like a window shade in a matter of days. The president of the United States had been to Red China. Not Ford, but Nixon. He had gone before he resigned. Nixon, of all people. The old witch hunter himself. If anyone but his dad had told him that, Johnny would have flatly refused to believe. It was all too much. It was too scary. Suddenly he didn't want to know anymore, for fear it might drive him totally crazy. That pen Dr. Brown had had, that flare, how many other things were like that? How many hundreds of little things, all of them making the point over and over again? You lost part of your life, almost 6%, if the actuarial tables are to be believed. You're behind the times. You missed out. John, the voice was soft. Are you asleep, John? He turned over. A dim silhouette stood in the doorway. A small man with rounded shoulders. It was Wyzak. No, I'm awake. I hoped so. May I come in? Yes, please do. Wyzak looked older tonight. He sat by Johnny's bed. I was on the phone earlier, he said. I called directory assistance for Carmel, California. I asked for a Mrs. Johanna Barentz. Do you think there was such a number? Unless it's unlisted or she doesn't have a phone at all, Johnny said. She has a phone. I was given the number. Ah, Johnny said. He was interested because he liked Wyzak, but that was all. He felt no need to have his knowledge of Johanna Barentz validated, because he knew it was valid knowledge. He knew in the same way he knew he was right-handed. I sat for a long time and thought about it, Wyzak said. I told you my mother was dead, but that was really only an assumption. My father died in the defense of Warsaw. My mother simply never turned up, no? It was logical to assume that she had been killed in the shelling during the occupation, you understand? She never turned up, so it was logical to assume that. Amnesia. As a neurologist, I can tell you that permanent general amnesia is very, very rare, probably rarer than true schizophrenia. I have never read of a documented case lasting 35 years. She recovered from her amnesia long ago, Johnny said. I think she simply blocked everything out. When her memory did come back, she had remarried and was the mother of two children, possibly three. Remembering became a guilt trip, maybe. But she dreams of you. The boy is safe. Did you call her? Yes, Wyzak said. I dialed it direct. Did you know you could do that now? Yes, it's a great convenience. You dial 1, the area code, the number, 11 digits, and you can be in touch with any place in the country. It is an amazing thing. In some ways, a frightening thing. A young man, answered the telephone. I asked if Mrs. Barentz was at home. I heard him call, Mom, it's for you. Clunk went the receiver on the table or desk or whatever. I stood in Bangor, Maine, not 40 miles from the Atlantic Ocean, and listened to a young man put the phone down on a table in a town on the Pacific Ocean. My heart, it was pounding so hard it frightened me. The wait seemed long. Then she picked up the phone and said, Yes? Hello?
What did you say? How did you handle it?
I did not, as you say, handle it, Wyzak replied, and smiled crookedly. I hung up the telephone, and I wished for a strong drink, but I did not have one.
Are you satisfied it was her?
John, what a naive question. I was 9 years old in 1939. I've not heard my mother's voice since then. She spoke only Polish when I knew her. I speak only English now. I've forgotten much of my native language, which is a shameful thing. How could I be satisfied one way or the other?
Yes, but were you?
Wyzak scrubbed a hand slowly across his forehead. Yes, he said. It was her. It was my mother.
But you couldn't talk to her?
Why should I? Wyzak asked, sounding almost angry. Her life is her life, no? It is as you said. The boy is safe. Should I upset a woman that is just coming into her years of peace? Should I take the chance of destroying her equilibrium forever? Those feelings of guilt you mentioned? Should I set them free? Or even run the risk of so doing?
I don't know, Johnny said.
They were troublesome questions, and the answers were beyond him. But he felt that Wyzak was trying to say something about what he had done by articulating the questions. the questions he could not answer. The boy is safe. The woman is safe in Carmel. The country is between them, and we let that be. But what about you, John? What are we going to do about you?
I don't understand what you mean.
I will spell it out for you then, no? Dr. Brown is angry. He is angry at me, angry at you, and angry at himself. I suspect, for half believing something, he has been sure is total poppycock for his whole life. The nurse who was a witness will never keep her silence. She will tell her husband tonight in bed, and it may end there. But her husband may tell his boss, and it is very possible that the papers will have wind of this by tomorrow evening. Gorma patient reawakens with second sight.
Second sight, Johnny said. Is that what it is?
I don't know what it is, not really. Is it psychic, seer, handy words that describe nothing, nothing at all? You told one of the nurses that her son's optic surgery was going to be successful.
Marie, Johnny murmured. He smiled a little. He liked Marie.
And that is already all over the hospital. Did you see the future? Is that what second sight is? I don't know. You put a picture of my mother between your hands, and you were able to tell me where she lives today. Do you know where lost things and lost people may be found? Is that what second sight is? I don't know. Can you read thoughts, influence objects of the physical world, heal by the laying on of hands? These are all things that some call psychic. They are all related to the idea of second sight. They are things that Dr. Brown laughs at. Laughs? No, he doesn't laugh. He scoffs.
And you don't?
I think of Edgar Cayce and Peter Hurkos. I tried to tell Dr. Brown about Hurkos and he scoffed. He doesn't want to talk about it. He doesn't want to know about it.
Johnny said nothing.
So, what are we going to do about you?
Does something need to be done?
I think so, Wyzak said. He stood up. I'll leave you to think it out for yourself. But when you think about this. Some things are better not seen, and some